It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, January the 11th, 2026. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets No G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And you could get me on the new and improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Join us for our chats. Sign up for premium content. Less than a cup of coffee a month. Get updates on the show. Interact with me. All at TheTalkingMetsPodcast.com. And of course, I want to thank the good folks from the Believe Network for supporting this show. Welcome to another edition of the Talking Mets podcast. As we get, the old saying is it's getting late early here in the offseason. Next week will be about 30 days out, and we always talk about Valentine's Day being that demarcation line where we end the hot stove and we start looking at pitchers and catchers in spring training, and there's a ton of free agents out there. Did Alex Bregman break the dam? Are we going to start to see movement? It was a weird weekend. Cody Bellinger, Scott Boras at a standstill with the Yankees. Are the Mets really involved? Will they get involved if 7 years is what Bellinger is going to hold out for? Are they in on Kyle Tucker? You keep hearing them as a team that's lurking. They weren't in on Bregman. Bregman got a big deal, 5 years, $175 million. He's kind of set the bar. What about Framber Valdez? What about Ranger Suarez? There's some speculation about the Mets landing an arm, some arm. And of course, we'll get into all that. I'll also, a big chunk of the show will be talked about the roster that they do have. And is this roster any good? Because if you start to look at projection systems, and the only one that I've been able to find is the Steamer projections over at Fangraphs, the Mets roster is looking not too bad. But there are things about it, there are aspects about the roster that are making people uncomfortable. I'll talk about that. And then after the break, we're going to get into some mailbag. I'm grabbing some tweets and some conversations from the week. Something new I'm going to add in addition to those who email me, but I'll grab throughout the week some interactions I have with various fans on X or email or the chat or whatever what you have be. And we'll chat about that. So let's get to where everything is here. So Alex Bregman signs with the Cubs. And that really, from the top of the market, makes you think that maybe it's time for this thing, this offseason, which maybe it's not the slowest offseason, but it's certainly one of the slower offseasons we've had from the top of the market. Things will get going. What was interesting is that, and I have no skin in the game on this, is here's the Red Sox. They trade Devers. I'm not all up on the Red Sox clubhouse culture, but obviously Devers and how he wanted to not play first base. And then we saw him play a little first base in San Francisco. And needless to say, there's a guy that, from what I saw, the couple of games that I watched, there's a guy that's not into first base. Let's put it that way. They open up a spot for Bregman. Bregman signs a pillow deal. You figure after a really good season in Boston, Fenway maybe being a great park for him, great guy in the clubhouse, what have you, that they would go all out to sign him. Well, if the reports are true, he basically left the Red Sox over $10 million. Now, there's some reports that there's about $70 million deferred in the Chicago deal. I don't know how significant the deferrals are in the Red Sox deal. But when you start to look at the structure of the Bregman deal, you have to think both Bellinger and Tucker are going to be in similar situations where even if Tucker, and I'm sure there'll be opt-outs in a Tucker deal if he signs something like 4 or 5 years, you have to think that there's some deferrals or there's some upfront money similar to what the Mets did with Pete Alonso. With Bellinger, I have to think, and look, I'm not surprised that Boras is going to 7 years. Did I not say, and I don't know how many shows you guys who are listening now have been listening to all offseason, I said looking at the AAV, looking at what Bellinger's versatility, his defense, the improvement of the bat, the fact that he's smack in the middle of his prime right now, Boras is going to look for a 7-year deal to bring him into his late 30s, going to look for 7 years and $200 million, an average AAV of 30. Obviously, I've heard some reports he wants 35, 36, 37. That's probably on a shorter-term deal, and that's a little bit more than I think I'd be comfortable going. But I've said it. There's been a couple of seasons. If you use the Fangraphs dollars to war converted, Bellinger has had some high 30s value seasons based on the analytics, and those are publicly available analytics. You don't have to go bananas there. Now, if you want to say, hey, he's been inconsistent, he's been up and down, he was an MVP with the Dodgers, he fell off a cliff, he came back, and he was up and down, not really up and down with the Cubs, but he had some better offensive seasons than other offensive seasons, so be it at that point. You can make that argument, but when you're in a free agency situation, and look, give Boris credit, and I saw some people complaining about how Boris is the reason why the sport is in bad shape. If you are a player, and you have Boris as your agent, you're there to make some money, and you're going to eventually make some money. Pete Alonso took a risk and made some money. So did Bregman. And look, Bellinger's trying to do the same thing too. And I know Mark Vientos now, and we talked about this in prior weeks, is with the Boris Corp. And I think part of being with the Boris Corp is not only the financial windfall that potentially could happen in arbitration or free agency, but also with the resources that Boris puts out in front of players to help them get better. No doubt about it, Pete Alonso was a better player. Now, is Boris part of that? Apparently, he did do some work with some of the resources that Boris put out. We'll see if Mark Vientos is also going to benefit from that. But as we head now into the back half of the offseason, the real question is, are the Mets really going to get involved with the top end of the market? Because you have to think something's percolating. And I tweeted about this, and I initially was wrong. But they quietly made a couple of moves. They put a scrap heap pickup, Romo, a catcher on waivers, lost them to the White Sox. Bay, the backup outfielder, they claimed off waivers from the Pirates. He was sent down to Syracuse. He cleared waivers. So the Mets now have two roster spots available. They quietly did that earlier in the week, which makes you think something's up. There's going to be a move. In about a month, on around the 10th of the month, the Mets could start, the 10th of February, I should say, the Mets can start to assign guys to the 60-day IL. That'll be Tyler McGill. That'll be Reed Garrett. That'll be Daniel Nunez. So keep in mind, part of what's going on right now is you have to play the 40-man roster game. And some of the fans forget that. You have to sign somebody. You have to make a move. Now, you could say, so look, they could, you know, there's guys on that roster that maybe you don't like, and you could say, hey, you know, why can't the Mets get rid of Joey Gerber, or can they get rid of Jared Young? Can they just designate them off the roster? Sure, they can do that, but maybe they like these guys. Maybe they like these guys for depth, and we'll see how the Mets play it out right now. Look, I wrote about this over at the premium content over at Beyond the Mic. I think when it comes to pitching, I was not one. I thought Ranger Suarez, although I think he's a nice 5-6 inning pitcher, and he was one of the top pitchers in the league from like July 1st on last year. He was like top 20. And if you remember, he showed a lot of moxie in that elimination game at Citi Field a couple of years ago. Didn't go deep, but he was able to keep the Mets scoreless and really battle. I think he struck out 8 over 4 and change. Ranger Suarez is a nice addition if they bring him in, especially if it's a shorter-term deal or a deal that has an opt-out. The thing about Ranger Suarez is I don't think he's really much different than what they have with Clay Holmes and Sean Manaea and Kodai Senga, where I think you could potentially get 5 or 6 good innings when those guys are on and possibly get 5 or 6 innings of 1-run, 2-run ball. You're just not getting the innings that will help you keep that bullpen fresh. And I think that's one of the biggest problems, because if you're going to have to get 9 to 12 outs every night, like they had to get even when things were good earlier in the year, you're going to burn out that bullpen. You're going to burn out that bullpen. Now, maybe they've figured out, hey, and they know they've got a couple of guys they've brought on that are multi-inning arms, and maybe they could still do that obnoxious shuttle, but you still want to have some innings. So that's where I think Valdez gets the nod. Valdez is a little older. And am I into giving any of these guys a 7-year deal? No, I'm not. I looked at the Corbin Burns deal and how that, you know, initially has gone bad in terms of injury. A lot of people predicted that he was about to break. And you got to be really careful with long-term pitcher deals. Look at Patrick Corbin. He was coming off a great year in Arizona. Had a really good 2019, the year they won the championship in D.C. And he was bad the rest of that contract. So that's a little bit of a different situation. He was healthy, but he was bad. So you really have to be right. When you bring in these guys, you give them long-term deals, you have to be right. So here's where I think the Mets are going to go. I think they are in on Tucker. I think they are in on Bellinger. I think they are in on Valdez. I think they are in on Ranger Suarez. I think they're all in on all of these big free agents. And I'm not so sure they're ready to rip apart the farm system and trade. And we wrote about it, and we were very prophetic over at Beyond the Mic with the Edward Cabrera trade. If the rumors are true, and our good friend Ernie Dove was one of the first to quietly report how much Miami liked A.J. Ewing, they wanted Brandon Sproat and A.J. Ewing for Edward Cabrera, which is a very expensive ask for a pitcher. I mean, you're basically asking the Mets to give up a top five prospect in Sproat, a top seven in Ewing, basically two top 10 prospects for Cabrera. I understand why Peter Bendix and the Miami Marlins are asking that. That's how they're going to stay competitive. They're trying to build the same thing that they had in Tampa. But that's expensive for a guy who's never pitched 200 innings and has a long history of injury and inconsistencies and injury as recently as this past August. But if that's where the expensive of market is going, we've heard the same thing with the Cardinals and Brendan Donovan and so on and so forth. If that's where the trade market's going, even with Freddy Peralta, they want a major league ready starter to go back, which I understand that a little bit more. And that's a rental. I mean, now you know why Scooble's still in the Detroit uniform. They're just going to ride that out. And if they're out of the race in July, then maybe things will get hot and heavy about acquiring him, similar to what happened back in the day. I'm going to date myself with Cliff Lee when Cliff Lee was put on the market and the Rangers acquired him at the deadline. And that helped them, you know, go to the World Series and what have you. But I don't think the Mets are going to really, at this point, rip apart this farm system. I think they're going to sit back. I think they're going to wait to see how these free agencies develop. I think they're going to wait and see how Tucker and can they land him on some kind of, I don't want to say pillow deal, but maybe something similar to Bregman where he comes back, he has a full season, he puts up a dynamite offensive season in a lineup with Soto, and then he could go back out in the market next year and get his 10-year deal because he's clearly not going to get it. Now, will Toronto bend and eventually say, hey, we'll give it to you? I think that also depends on Bo Bichette, which everybody has penciled in because of Don Mattingly with the Phillies, which I think is kind of weird unless they really know something because I think money talks. So I think there's a lot of things in play. I think Bregman has been the first domino to fall here. I think this is going to be an interesting week. I don't think Bellinger and Tucker are necessarily holding each other up, but I think the first one that signs is just going to push the other guy to figure something out. Could I see a Bellinger? I mean, Boris has done this before. Hold out and really put the Yankees up against it and go into spring training. I mean, he's done it before. He did it with Kyle Loesch. He did it with Steven Drew. Now, I don't know if Bellinger wants to do this again. Because why would Bellinger, who's already kind of signed the deal in the past with less than what he wanted, why would he do that again? It just doesn't make any sense. So it's going to be interesting. I will say this. As we head into the mid to late January, I think it's going to be really, really interesting how all this free agency plays out. I think the Mets are doing what they are going to do consistently as long as Stearns is running the show, is sit back and wait and find out where these markets are going and get these players at the best price possible. Now, I know that drives all of you nuts, and let's face it, we go back to the Will Salmon article from spring training where an agent basically said that Stearns is good at that. He's really good at that. The difference is this. When they really want someone, i.e. Soto, and you want to play at the top of that market, they'll play at the top of the market. They did it with Yamamoto as well. They lost out on one. They won the other. So they have played aggressively in those markets. But they're not going to do it when they feel a market is a little bit more tepid, the players over asking, and the competition is not quite as fierce as it was with both of those examples I gave. Those guys were in prime, elite hitter, in prime, promising pitcher, who has proven with his performance in the postseason this year to be worth, at least now, every bit at what he's worth. Now, let's put all this aside. We've been talking a lot throughout the entire offseason about free agency, about the plan, justifying the plan, explaining what Stearns is doing, crying over Alonso, crying over Diaz. All the things we've been talking about, we're tired of it. I'm tired of it. I'm sure you're tired of it too. So I think today what I wanted to do, and I was starting to get the itch as I saw fans tweeting out some of the projections that are out there. And I'm on FanGraphs right now. They have usually a good clearinghouse of projection systems. And they have a few. Steamer, the Bat, the Bat X, OOPSY, and Zips is another one. That's not available yet. I'm just going to go with Steamer just to start, just to kind of get a feel of what they see. Now, here's where I know the uncomfortability of the current team is. And what's interesting is that a fan base that largely has been pining, and I know this because I listened to it over and over again when Alderson was with the team and they wouldn't rebuild and they continue to leverage and double down and triple down on the pitching they had post 2015. They wanted Heim Bloom. Everybody kept saying they need to have a young, smart, analytical GM who I knew. And that was really why Brody Van Wagenen got the job when the Wilpons was still around and they had moved away from Alderson when he got sick. Everybody came in and said, look, I want to rebuild this thing. I want to blow this thing up. And Brody was the only one that, from what I remember, was like, hey, we can make something of this. And he was right. And I think that's where we are today, where the half measure and constantly trying to re-leverage and squeeze in any kind of development and leverage by trading prospects, which Brody did a lot of that. And that's not what's going to happen anymore right now. So the real thing that you're not comfortable with is really what you were asking for quite some time. And maybe part of that, you have less of an appetite for that because now you have one of the richest owners in sports. Maybe 1 and 1A if you want to put the Rogers Corp right up there with Cohen, because they certainly could spend with Cohen. Your uncomfortability is that Stearns is going into this year really feeling good. Whatever he has in terms of scouting information, projections, whatever it may be, he feels good that he can incorporate a couple of his young players, the Carson Benjes, the Jet Williams, maybe an A.J. Ewing, maybe a couple of more of the arms. If it's not Tong and Sproat, maybe it's a Jack Winiger. Maybe it's a Will Watson. Maybe Ryan Clifford could force his way in. So Jonathan Santucci. I'm just throwing names out. I've heard some things. Our friend Ernie Dove talk about Chris Suero too, who's in AA. We have Nick Morabito now. Maybe he's just a backup energy player, but he's on the 40-man roster. So he's feeling good about finally this top five farm system. He's finally feeling good about having it become part of the solution. And that makes you really uncomfortable because it's all speculation. It relies on us not looking at the back of the baseball card or the front of the baseball reference page. It relies on us to go to things like Steamer and Fangraphs and look at how they project. And we have no idea how they came up with these numbers. Don't even ask me how to explain it. We have no idea if any of these numbers will ever come to fruition. And that makes us very, very nervous. And that's okay. I understand that. But here's what I do know. And let's just look at the facts. Here's the guarantees. They have two top 10 offensive players in Lindor and Soto. They have that. That's a great foundation. They have an elite shortstop. I know some people are concerned that he's on the back end of his prime and he showed some decline. I feel like his fielding was more clumsy than it was physical with the errors that he made. The bat is streaky. It's always been streaky, but I didn't see the bat slow down at all. And he seems to be a guy that thrives in the big spot and wants that big spot and wants to be the guy that leads this team. And he's going to have that opportunity now that a lot of the holdovers that were here before him, the Nimmos, the Alonzos, the McNeils, are gone. It's clearly going to be Lindor and Soto's clubhouse. I mean, you already see Soto and with the WBC, some of the players who want to play with him in the WBC. Lindor has always been a popular guy when it comes to his fraternity of ball players there. So that's off the bat. Now, the projection systems are rather kind to some of the other veterans that we're not so sure about. A Marcus Semien looking at 2080. Jorge Polanco, 2060 at that point. Even a Mark Vientos, a holdover, 2565, 25 home runs. And I think Mark Vientos will be one of them. But the real key right now with the projection systems, because what you're saying and what you're thinking is that if they don't get Tucker, if they don't get a Bellinger, if they don't get, I mean, I even have seen them people throw out there Bo Bichette, who would have to be, I don't know where he would play. It'd be a third baseman or a second baseman. I don't, there's no room at short. He's not a shortstop. Some teams are not looking at that short. And I guess you'd rather have Bo Bichette in his prime than Brett Beatty. And that's where I'm going. I think the uncomfortability with a lot of Mets fans, which is really interesting, and I've been very critical of these kids. But I'm at a point where you got to just sit back and give them a shot. And I think this is their shot. This is their opportunity. This is their crossroads, at very least in a Mets uniform, or to be an impactful core member of a team here in New York. But Brett Baty and Francisco Alvarez are the two, I think, right now that are going to be key for the Mets, even if they sign a Kyle Tucker or a Bellinger or another bat, even if it's not the most impactful bat. Because what Stearns is betting on is that Baty, who right now, according to the projection system, is going to hit about 250, going to have about a 108 run creation. He's going to have 15 home run-ish type of situation. And they only have him for about 95 games, right? So if Brett Baty, you take those 95 games and you just quickly do some ratio math, you're looking at a guy that could hit 20 to 25 home runs, driving 70 to 80 runs, play really, I mean, he's turned himself to a really solid third baseman, and easily make up the production that you lost with Brandon Nimmo. Actually, Jorge Polanco should do that. Now, whether he could play first base in any kind of capacity, we'll see in spring training. And I have a feeling he's going to move around the diamond a little bit at times. But Brett Baty, it's not far-fetched. I mean, if you look at last year, I'm just going to bring up Baty real quick. Let's just start with him. Baty last year in 130 games hit 18 home runs, drove in 50 runs, and had a 111 OPS plus. So his first year in his career that he's above league average. Still strikes out a little bit much. Still doesn't walk as much as you like. Still is a little streaky. And remember, he was doing this flipping around from second base and third base. So he's trying to learn another position. In August, when everybody else was hot, he had a 937 OPS. But in September, down the stretch, before he got hurt, he hit 271. He had three home runs, nine RBIs, a 317 on-base percentage, a 458 slugging, a 775 OPS. If you could get a 780 to 800 OPS at third base from Brett Baty, it's pretty solid. And then there's Alvarez. And Alvarez is the one that I know everybody now. I noticed just bringing up some of the projections where I said, hey, if Alvarez could be the 30 home run, 190 to 100 RBI, even if he only plays 130 games, because you figure a catcher is going to need time off. He's got a history of injuries. They're going to want to give him a blow. Torrens is a very good backup catcher. There's no reason. And finally, hit his potential. I mean, that basically makes up a lot of Alonso's production. Well, you're getting it from catcher, but you're losing it first base. But Polanco will more than make up for that when you look at what you were getting out of your catchers in prior years. I mean, here's a guy last year, Alvarez, that crushed left-handed pitching to a 950 OPS. In the second half of the year, he had a 921 OPS, had eight home runs and 21 RBIs in 35 games. You look at that over 500 at-bats, that's a 40 home run pace. I'm not saying he's going to keep up with that, but he was really good. And look, he spent a good chunk of August with an OPS over 1,000. He wasn't bad in September. At 784 OPS, hit only 230. But this is a guy that slugs. This is a guy that's essentially a very streaky hitter. So that's really where a lot of the faith, I guess, in the Mets offense producing at a similar level. And when we get some projections and we finally see the final roster, we'll do our usual how many runs should the Mets score. Last year we had them at like five runs a game, and you and I know that they really never played at that level until really August. The other piece of this, and I don't know where the Mets stand on him, but it's interesting because, like I said earlier, he's working with Boris. I think Boris will put him in front of some of the best resources that he can find. Boris is not going to take on a client because he thinks he's a diamond in the rough. He sees something in Mark Vientos. And if he sees something in Mark Vientos, he sees dollars at the end of that rainbow. So if Boris sees dollars and Boris sees something, we should see something. We all know the guy could hit home runs. We saw it. We also saw, to be fair, and again, I've been critical of him, we saw him in a big spot in the postseason in 2024 against the Phillies in the ninth inning, against the Dodgers with the salami in a big spot when they needed it in game two. We've seen him come up big. His value's in his bat. Can he learn to play acceptable defense? Well, we saw a little bit of that in 2024, but let's face it, that's not, he's never going to be, if he doesn't hit, he's never going to make it out with his make it up with his glove. Can this guy be the Mets version of Eugenio Suarez, who, by the way, is available? But when you look at it, why can't he be a 25 to 30 home run guy? Why can't he be more consistent? And look, I ran the numbers. There was basically an 11-hit difference from the year before. And he had another 10 home runs. Remember, earlier in the year when nothing was dropping, you always kept hearing he's hitting the ball hard. He hits the ball hard. Now, I think sometimes we take these metrics and we make a bigger deal of them than they really are, because you can hit the ball hard all you want. If you hit it on the ground right at somebody, it's still an out. But there's something there. And if Boris sees something, I think we should see something. So when you look at the Mets offense, and I haven't got to the pitching yet, and I think that's where you guys are going to be most uncomfortable, but we'll get into that. When you look at the Mets offense, you still have two top offensive players. The projection system, at least Steamer, still feels good about the Simeons and the Polanco's. And then you're looking at your kids, finally now, with Alonzo McNeil, Nimmo gone, can they slide in and be that spot? Now, they're also starting to see a Carson Benj, a Jet Williams, a Ryan Clifford, at some point, maybe not opening day, contribute. They see a Carson Benj contributing at a rate where he could be a 15 to 20 home run guy and a 70 to 80 RBI guy early on. The comp we've always heard about him is Nick Markakis. If he could be an in-prime Nick Markakis, that's not a bad bat to have. So when you start to look at what's in front, offense is really not something, even without a Kyle Tucker, that, and again, I understand that it's predicated on a lot of ifs and kids that you've seen for now almost 4 years and kids that have frustrated you. But also remember, part of what Stearns has done this offseason is revamp the entire coaching staff, because I think he believes part of why his players at the big league level have not developed, because when they went down to the minors, they all did very well, including Ronnie Mauricio in the brief time he was there. He probably needs more time there. I think he felt the coaching was lacking at the big league level, and he made the appropriate changes. We'll see if it works. Now, on the pitching side, that's where I think there'll be some more, trepidation about how good they could be. Look, we know how bad they were in the second half. And I think to a certain degree, a lot of that had to do certainly with injury and overuse. But the fact that two parts of their starting rotation, Sean Manaea and Frankie Montas, were never really part of it. If you read, now, I don't know if you guys read the column, but Joel Sherman wrote that the Mets feel very good about Sean Manaea. Now, you don't have to go far. I mean, this is just, again, it's right in front of you. Sean Manaea actually had a tremendous walk-to-strikeout ratio last year. He had a walk rate under 2, and he had a strikeout ratio of 11.1. And I know he made a couple of relief outings out of that, so keep that in mind. I know he had a 5.64 overall ERA, but his expected ERA was over a run less. So there was some bad luck there. I think the Mets feel Sean Manaea is not the pitcher we saw in 2025, but more like the pitcher that we saw in 2024, who could win you 12 to 15 ball games. I don't want to say he's an ace, but I mean, Sean Manaea got Cy Young Award votes in 2024. Let's put it that way. So they feel good about him. We know when Senga is on, he can be dominant. I mean, he has a lot of explaining to do about this whole, my mechanics aren't perfect and I need to not pitch. I mean, that's something he's going to have to work out. Clay Holmes had a big boy outing late in the year, and we talked about him. He made 31 starts. Again, these are very good. At the very least, these are very good starters. And we haven't even gotten into Nolan McClain, who has top of the rotation stuff. Can Tong or Sproat, maybe not out of the gate, come in and and make the club out of spring training. I understand there's going to be some inning situations at some point. Christian Scott's in the mix. I do believe the Mets will sign a veteran pitcher. Will they sign at the top of the market, which this top of the market is Valdez or Ranger Suarez, or will they go a little bit lower and maybe go to a Lucas Giolito or to a Chris Bassett or another veteran like Justin Verlander, who, by the way, you know, when I mentioned Justin Verlander over at Beyond the Mic a couple of weeks ago, I went into Fangraphs. He was a top 15, 20 pitcher in the second half of the year in baseball. So he might still have some stuff. Don't discount it. I know that's not where you want to go, and I know that that could. We're all aware those guys like Verlander, like Scherzer, they could lose it overnight. We saw it with Tom Glavine to a certain degree. We saw it with Scherzer in his time with the Mets. Not as bad as Glavine. So when you start to really take a step back, when you start to put the emotion aside, it's not a bad starting rotation. It's not. It needs an ace. And I think that that is going to be something that they're going to address next offseason. And if you look at some of the successful teams in Mets history, recent successful teams, the 2015 team was built on pitching. But the last two really successful teams prior to 2015, the 06 team and the 99-2000 group, okay, they had Mike Hampton and Al Leiter. And I know Mike Hampton was a guy that was a top five pitcher when they acquired him. But even the 99 team, let's just go to that one. Al Leiter was a very good number two, but everybody else in that rotation was a number three. Rick Reed, Masato Yoshii, even Kenny Rogers when he came over in the trade later in the year. They were built on bats and bullpen. Now, that's where I know the other thing that makes you uncomfortable is the Diaz for Devin Williams swap out. And you have Luke Weaver now, and you have some nice pieces in A.J. Minter and Brooks Raley and Adbert Alzolay, who was a closer with Chicago a couple of years ago coming off an injury. And let's see if a Dylan Ross or a Jonathan Pintaro or a Ryan Lambert out of the system. And that's one of the things, you know, just throwing it in there that we'll kind of dive into this week over at the Premium Content Beyond the Mic is look at some of these bullpen arms. You know, can the Mets finally rely on some bullpen arms? And don't forget, Nate Lavender's back in the organization too. So it'll be interesting, and Stearns always loves to play chemistry experiment. Maybe he's got something more here. Yes, I am taking a glass half full approach with this whole projection system. I understand that. But I'm not the one putting the projections together. This is Fangraphs. And historically, these analytically based sites are not always that kind to the Mets. Let's put it that way. Now, does that mean they shouldn't sign Tucker, Bellinger, or try to get a Framber Valdez or a Ranger Suarez? Giolito or another arm that could provide some innings. No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying, though, is that they have a really good base. And if you read, and I know he's a premium content, you read Sherman's piece. They love Devin Williams right now. They believe in Carson Benj in a big-time way. And they believe in Sean Manaea. And personally, I mean, maybe they'll be wrong, but they think that Devin Williams could be just as good, if not better, than Edward Diaz at this point in his career. They like the component offense they've put around the two top 10 stars. They're looking at this completely different than you and I are looking at this. And that's why Stearns is getting paid $10 million a year. Now, you could say, well, look at last year, but guy's got a track record in Milwaukee. And I know what you're going to say. I've seen it all. I've heard it all. You know, he didn't win anything in Milwaukee. Still was on a budget and was a very competitive team. And somebody posted this, and I thought it was interesting. And this is a lineup that did score 5 runs in Game 6, the game that they lost. But the lineup for Game 6 going into an elimination game in L.A. against the Dodgers 2 years ago, a team we all love, was Lindor at short, Nimmo in left, Vientos at third, Alonso at first, Winker at the DH, Marte in right, Taylor in center, McNeil at second, Alvarez at behind the plate. Nobody was complaining that night about that lineup. Now, yes, you put in Soto last year in right, moved Marte to the DH, you enhanced it. And yes, Vientos had a down year, and Taylor was hitting like a pitcher for a good chunk of the season. McNeil was inconsistent and Alvarez was injured. But when you look at that lineup and you look at what the Mets have right now, even without Tucker and Bellinger, it's not that far off. Now, the pitching, look, You're relying on some of the same characters, the Shamanias, component bullpen, Kodai Senga, guys like that. I don't think the Mets have a choice right now. I think they want to give their prospects another year to develop. They will trade some. I'm not sure that they 100% know how all these guys are going to develop. And I think that the names that we're going to be looking at this year that are going to either be a part of the solution or on the way out are going to be Jet Williams, are going to be A.J. Ewing, Jacob Reimer, Ryan Clifford, Will Watson, Jack Reniger, Chris Suero, guys like that. And then Nick Morabito. And even if it's a backup outfielder, the fact that the Mets actually might legitimately have a cost-controlled backup outfielder, so they don't have to go out and spend on a veteran that may or may not make it. You know, how many Keon Broxtons have they brought in over the years that just fizzled out because they didn't have anything in the system to be a backup? And with guys like Morabito and Ewing, for the first time maybe ever, the Mets are going to have a real speed component to their lineup. I don't even remember. They've had Reyes in the past and what have you. You know, Lenny Dykstra and Wally Backman back in the day had some wheels. Maybe a Lance Johnson. Ricky Henderson, that one year, he found the fountain of youth in the late 90s. But the Mets have never had a burner team. I'm not saying, I hate when everyone says it's like the 80s Cardinals. That's not what I'm saying here. That's an anomaly. That's a whole different era of baseball. But it's going to be interesting. So, yes, I'm giving you a glass half full, but I'm taking it from Fangraph's steamer projections. And if you want to say I'm an idiot and I don't know what I'm talking about and you're a shill, well, look, you have every right to be negative and not feel good. But this is how organizations are built. And you cannot every offseason buy every player and keep your minor leaguers in the system until you're comfortable that they're 100% ready and mitigate every bit of risk. You have to take risk. There has to be some calculated risk. And it's a combination of established stars, established veterans, established component, and matriculating your kids in there. And that's exactly what Stearns is doing. And I think Carson Benj is going to be the first, I guess, poster child of that come spring training. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll do some mailbag. I'll include some tweets this week. We'll talk about a bunch of different topics as we wrap up the show right after this. All right, we're back. So during the break, I was looking at MLB Trade Rumors Twitter to see what X, whatever you want to call it, to see if there's any update. You know, I held out a little bit today to later in the day. It's right around 6:15 now. I'm recording this to see if there was any updates on free agency. But right now, nothing. With my luck, once I post this, I'll have to do an emergency show that the Mets signed. Maybe Kyle Tucker. Who knows? So that's where we'll start. Let me read. Let's get to the mailbag and some of the commentary on X. Ben wrote to me, "I listened to your short. The reason the Astros didn't extend Tucker was that they have a rule against extending players over 5 years. It's why they've lost so many core players. Cubs ownership will spend, but they don't like giving out massive contracts." I guess, Ben, I would say maybe we're wrong on that, but they did defer a ton on the Bregman deal. They did under Theo, but those days have been over for like 7 years now. Kyle Tucker is really freaking good. He was playing better than Soto last year before he suffered his wrist hand injury. He foolishly played through it, which hampered his numbers. Still finished with an .840 OPS. His batted ball data over the last 3 years is on another level compared to Bellinger's. Bellinger's defense will slip soon. He's not going to stay in center very long. Tucker's bat is a much better bet in the future. More reasons to sign Tucker? The bats in free agency over the next few years aren't strong. Get the difference maker now. He just turned 29. Lindor also showed some signs of declining. Still a good player, but declining nonetheless. Prevent the Dodgers and Blue Jays from getting better. So that's a great comment by Ben. Here's the deal, Ben. I still, and I know our friend over in the chat, Metavitter 156, who has always a lot to say, said, you know, "Hey, Mike, Kyle Tucker's a better player than Cody Bellinger." Look, you could flip this anyway. As a hitter, sure. The numbers bear it out. But I liked Bellinger's versatility. I liked the fact that he could play three positions, actually four when you put in center field. Three of them he plays really well. In center, he's more than competent. Okay? I like that. Do I like him at 7 years and $210 million? I don't see any world where the Mets go that route. Right now, if he wants the years, he's going to have to go back to the Yankees, and he's probably going to have to accept less than 7 years, unless somebody else is popping in here. Now, and Will Salmon has been on this over and over and over again, the Mets are willing to go shorter term, higher AAV. Would they go 35, 36, 37 with a Bellinger or a Tucker? Maybe 40 with Tucker? Think 4 years, $160 million? I could see them do that. I'm sure Tucker would want an opt-out on that. You put Soto in left, Tucker in right. You have Taylor in center. Polanco at first, Simeon at second, Lindor at short, Beatty at third, Alvarez behind the plate. The only problem I have with that lineup is you're relying on your catcher, a second baseman who's coming off a serious injury. Of course, Polanco is righty. Lindor is a switch hitter. He's righty. You're really left-handed heavy. You really are. Now, while I have the numbers up here, Kyle Tucker, Baseball Reference. I have so many windows up here. Tucker's historically, I'm just going to look at his career numbers against lefties. I don't think they're really a problem. And lefties are not, you're going to see more righties than lefties, but I'm thinking more. Yeah, I mean, he's pretty solid against both sides of the plate. So maybe that's not a big deal. But the Mets are a little bit lefty heavy. You bring in Tucker, then I guess you're committing to Benj playing in center field, which I've been told Benj really isn't a center fielder. So it really makes me wonder how serious they are in Tucker, because the vibe, and you just heard Joel Sherman write about it over at the New York Post premium content, is that they really like Benj. How deep will they go? That's where Bellinger could slide to first. He's just got more versatility. But you hear more about the Mets lurking on Tucker than Bellinger. The Mets have really been stealth this offseason. I got to give the front office credit. I don't even know how they get the agents to keep their mouth shut. It's actually kind of amazing. Steve writes to me, the fans are mistreated. Steve, something that's gone on the radar was Tim Britton's reporting that Steve Cohen really didn't grow up a Mets fan. If anything, he was more of a Yankees guy. This is a big deal because Steve himself put on a false bravado that he was a diehard Mets fan. Being lied to is an insult. Don't act like Mr. Met when you're more of a Yankees guy. Now, it makes sense that he lets go of all these popular Mets because he never was a Mets fan. We were lied to. Hiring a reporter who mistreated fans, blocked 70% of them, and acted pompously is another signal that the fans' feelings aren't being considered. What Steve is talking about is the Andy Martino hire. This is the most unpopular reporter linked with the Mets, and they hire him. Slap in the face. I'm disappointed you support him. You have no problem calling out the local media, yet you aren't calling out the biggest hack of them all. Make big moves to cancel this out because this is a bad PR mess. So Steve is angry, and thank you, Steve. I think you frequently email, and I appreciate that. First, let me play this in a couple of different ways here. I never felt Steve Cohen was living and dying Mets. I think he was a casual fan. He's a guy that spent a lot of his early life making a lot of money. Read Black. You want to learn about Steve Cohen, Steve, or anybody here? If you don't have time to read, because I know it's hard to really just sit and focus and read, get the audiobook of Black Edge. I'm telling you, I know it's a financial book. There's actually some of the characters from the GameStop movie. If you guys watch the GameStop movie, I think that's called Stupid Money, are in there too. Even if you're not a finance guy, there is some hardcore finance stuff about it. You'll get a feel of who Cohen is. Really, you will get a feel of who Cohen is. I never felt he was a hardcore Mets fan. His wife and his wife's family, that's a different story. And I think Alex Cohen is very much involved. So I don't think so. Now, remember, Cohen tried to buy the Dodgers and was stopped about 15 years ago. Cohen was close to being the Dodgers guy, not the Mets guy. And the Mets had, if you remember the Mets, and I can't remember his name now, the Mets had a deal about 15 years ago with another equity guy that bailed out because Wilpons basically won. And I can't remember the guy's name right now, and it'll come to me at some point, and I will get it for you. Yeah, I've been looking it up. I just can't find it. But remember, the Mets had another investor. So when Cohen bought it, it certainly was an investment. I don't think it's just about the casino. But let's put it this way. He said this publicly from day one. Taking his money, what was it, $2.5 billion, $3 billion he spent for the Mets, and putting it into a baseball team, that's not the best return on investment, especially at the point he bought it, especially if he wants to get out of this thing quickly. And the people that made big money on teams, they bought the teams in the 70s, the 80s, 90s, and they bought them for $100, $200 million and sell them for $3 billion. That's the kind of, I don't know if the people that buy them at $2, $3, $4, $5 billion are going to sell these teams in 20 years, 30 years for $30, $40 billion. I don't know. I'm not the guy to ask that question, but I find it a little hard to believe you're buying at the higher end of the market. Now, the money you could make around that with a casino, with some of the other amenities that you can put around the team, that's a different ballgame. A team of itself is not all that lucrative. I know people don't believe that, but it's not all that lucrative. I don't think Cohen is disrespecting people. I don't think Cohen is jettisoning popular Mets because he doesn't care. I think the bottom line is he gave it to David Stearns the task to build this team and to build a sustainable long-term winner. And Stearns looked at a core of players that he felt maxed out. And if he was going to bring them back, it was going to be on very short-term deals. I mean, they don't want to give Kyle Tucker more than 4 or 5 years. What world makes you think they were ever going to give Pete Alonso a 5-year deal? They're hemming and hawing about Kyle Tucker. The Diaz thing, a little bit different. Similar to what happened with the Sox and Bregman. Red Sox thought they had Bregman. Bregman went for a little bit more money to Chicago. Makes you wonder if he ever wanted to be in Boston. We have to wonder if Diaz really wanted to stay with the Mets. Maybe it was because it was the Dodgers, because apparently he had a 5-year deal with Atlanta and he didn't jump there. I don't think any of the moves were made because Cohen doesn't care. I think Cohen has put Stearns in charge of the roster, in charge of the baseball, and that's what his should be. This was a bone of contention when the Wilpons were in charge for years and years and years, that they would get involved, they would intrude, they would listen to the fans and the media too much. I'm sorry, like, you can't run a baseball team that way. And if they're wrong, and if Stearns is wrong, and this all blows up in their face, and Pete's a 500 home run guy, and he's consistently hitting 40 to 45 home runs, and we're seeing a back half of Pete's career that's better than the first half, the front half of his career, then, you know, look, he's wrong. But I have a feeling that's not going to be the case. Now, as far as the Martino situation and him blocking the fans, I am not a huge, like, I have issues with Martino too. I'm not here to say Martino has handled himself online great. He gets too involved in politics. I don't like when writers block people. I've been blocked. I'm blocked by Mark Feinsohn. Why? Because I felt he was behaving like a Yankee shill at some point and called him out. He blocked me. I've been blocked by a number. Blocked by Craig Carton. And I've never cursed. I never hit anybody below the belt. Sometimes when you call people out for bad behavior, they can't handle it. I don't think that's the right way to do it. I know John Heyman, who follows me, and I respect John and his career. I know he blocks people, and I don't think that's the case. I only block bot accounts or if somebody really goes way above the line. Some of the mutes I do are people that are on sports that are just not talking sports. If you're going to be in the sports sphere and I see more non-sports conversation on my feet, I'm going to mute you. I don't need that. I have lists that I put out, and I put people on different lists for different reasons, and I view those lists personally for myself. And if I want a topic, I want to read about the Knicks, I go to my Knicks list. I want to read about the Mets, I go to my Mets list. I want to read about world's affairs, I got my politics and news. Like, I'll do that when I need it. I don't need that to be on my Mets list. Here's why I think Andy Martino is important. And I said this in the premium content, the short. I think the Mets are not being covered appropriately. I think the game is complex now. I think the managing of a roster is complex. I think the managing of the business of baseball is complex. I think all these things, especially with a new CBA coming on, are complex. And you need somebody. And I think Joel Sherman did a very fine job of it in his column at Post Plus. And Joel does a good job of this stuff. And to a certain degree, I think Joel, unlike some of the other writers, including those of the Post, is much more balanced when it comes to giving the rationale of what teams do. He also gets into big ideas sometimes, and I think he sometimes is a little bit too Yankee-centric. Remember, he's basically grew up a Yankees fan. It's not hard to find that out. I think his dad was a Brooklyn Dodgers fan, I'm not mistaken. I think I looked up some stuff, but it doesn't matter anymore. I think there's not enough of that. I think that there's a lot of hot takes. I think WFAN is horrible for the fan base because all it's doing is getting you radicalized on being angry, and that's not good. It's giving out misinformation. Nobody takes the time like we do here. How many people this week are going to look at the projection system on WFAN and have the conversation that I had today? Not many. Not many. Probably nobody. Now, I know maybe this is a niche business and it's not going to sell on the airwaves. I disagree. I do think it's a niche business. What I think Andy Martino is going to do, and I know what you're going to say, and we'll have to see. He's just going to be a mouthpiece for the organization. Let's give him a chance to do the good journalism that he did. And if you don't believe me, he did a book about the Yankees, the Yankee Way, which focused on Cashman taking over and what he's done with the organization. Listen to the audio book, read it, and then come back and tell me if he was a shill for the Yankees, because I don't think he was. And he purposely told Cashman, and even Cashman didn't want it to be an ode to him. You're always going to feel sympathetic to your topic. We talked about this in prior weeks. And I think he was a little bit more sympathetic to the Yankee plight with his reporting when he was at SNY with both teams. But I think that Andy has always been clued in with the Mets, has always done a good job in explaining what the organization is trying to do, especially when the Wilpons were in charge. I don't know who his sources have been in the organization, but I'm hoping that he's going to do that, and he's going to put good information out, because the Mets don't leak. The media speculates. The media doesn't add the business component or explain to the fans, hey, this team has already spent $303 million. Okay, there's luxury tax implications. There's a farm system. There's looking forward and looking now. Everybody in baseball and the media looks at now. And I think that they're trying to see if Andy could help them out a little bit that. So I understand, Steve, your frustration. I don't agree with everything, and I don't like how Andy's talked about his politics in the feed, and that's his right, and I don't like it. And I think that now that he's a baseball reporter, stick to baseball. Unless the intersection happens, you know, you go have your own account to talk about politics, talk about music, talk about this. I mean, look, that's inevitably going to happen. I mean, once in a while, I'll have like a Knicks comment in my feed, but that's still sports. But you don't see me really talking about, hey, I went to dinner today, guys, and I saw this celebrity, and I try to stay away from it. You know, sometimes I do some funny stuff, but not often so. On that note, our friend Bill Meyer wrote over on X, sentimentalism rules the fan base. Unhealthy attachment. Memories are good, but it's a new year. I want to win. And that's exactly it. I think that a lot of that was part of a conversation where I think we were talking about how fans seem to be more inclined to be in love with players than the laundry. And I'm more of a laundry guy. You get over players quick. So we'll see. This was an interesting debate, and maybe it's something that'll, with the Hall of Fame coming up. So Hagen Snell wrote, Jacob DeGrom deserves and likely will get his number 48 retired by the Mets. I don't know if that's the case. I think Jake will be in the Mets Hall of Fame. And in the back half of his career, he had a very good year last year. If he continues to rack up, you know, top 10 pitching performances and whatnot. And I'll look at him. Let me look at him real quick because he missed some time. So Jacob DeGrom's 37, right? It's amazing that he's 37 already. Yeah, he's 37. He's got a couple more years left on his Texas contract. Finished eighth in the Cy Young Award last year. 30 starts, 12-8, 2.97 ERA. Strikeout rates kind of dipped down to his early career levels. I suspect that that's probably where he's going to be post his second Tommy John. 96 and 65. You know, maybe he plays at a high level for three more years. I don't know if Jake is a guy that's going to play late into his 40s. He made a lot of money. I don't get the sense. I don't know him. I don't get the sense he's got this, like, I'm going to play to him 45 like Verlander. Maybe he puts another 30 wins in his career. Finishes about 125 and, you know, maybe 125 and 90. Probably not a Hall of Famer. I wouldn't put him in the Hall of Fame. Mets' career was 9 years. Close. 155 ERA plus. Does he get his number retired? How he left? The constant talk about not wanting to be there the last couple of years? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know how much love Jake really has for the Mets, to tell you the truth. I never felt he played, I don't know. There was always this feeling that he was just like, blah. You know, and maybe that's just his personality. So, Mets Hall of Fame, yes, retired number. Not right now, I don't see that. Let's see what else we have here. I've been going on X and looking at some of the commentaries that we've been getting. We'll do a few more of this. We have some time here. I think that some of these other tweets here, I'm not going to go into all of them, but the conversation was centered around the Mets not necessarily having some kind of like state of the union with the fans. And personally, I go back to what I said. Maybe the Martino hire is part of that to kind of help with that. I would hope. I don't want him just doing the Rising Apple podcast. I mean, it's silly. if that's what it really is. But honestly, this isn't the White House. This isn't a briefing on a White House briefing. We don't have any right to anything. Now, I understand what people are going to say. People are going to say that, hey, I have a right to know what the hell is going on. I want to buy tickets. My kids liked Alonzo and Diaz. They liked the trumpets. They liked Pete and the polar bear. Actually, when we did a Twitter Spaces earlier in the offseason, that was a comment that was brought up by a fan. It's fair. So the Mets are very well aware. They can't run their team based on that. And, you know, what if Stern's going to come out and say, hey, we're looking at... He really has. He's basically said, hey, we're going to give the kids a chance. We're looking at all the areas of the market. We're going to be opportunistic. They're not going to say, hey, I'm this far down the road with Bellinger. I like Tucker. I like Valdez. Like, they're just not... It doesn't make any sense. I'm sorry. Now, better reporting maybe could give you an idea. Look, I gave you the idea. I read you what Joel Sherman put on Post Plus. I told you about how they're really into their kids. I gave you the projection system. You have a pretty good idea what kind of team the Mets are going to have with Kyle Tucker, with Bellinger, or whatnot, with another arm or with not. So if you don't want to wait, if Kyle Tucker's the difference between you buying tickets or not, then I don't know what to tell you on that. I'm not saying that's wrong, but I don't know what to tell you. Mets Metrics. This is a really interesting account. I just started following at _ Mets Metrics. And he had, I don't know, I think this is from Fangraphs, but he has the Mets at the sixth highest currently wins above replacement in the sport. And they're at, so their hitters, what are their pitching? Their pitching is, they're kind of in the same bend with the pitching. The pitching's a little bit further down than the hitting. But that's interesting. That's interesting that they have that kind of, probably a lot of that is Soto and Lindor, but I thought that was an interesting stat. So, you know, Mets have a good base to work off here going into the season. And you know Stearns is a guy that's not afraid to mess around at the deadline. One of the other pieces of conversation, Rob Manfred was on WFAN, and he talked about the state of the sport. And I think that another thing, and maybe we'll wrap up on this a little bit. Another thing, there's two couple things that Manfred brought up I wanted to give my commentary on. One was an in-season tournament like the NBA. Now, I'm a Knicks fan. I thought I'm still not totally into the NBA in-season tournament. I think I got into the championship game a little bit because I think as a Knicks fan, it was something that this team, this group that has grown and developed together over the last 3 years needed to kind of maybe take the next step. Now, obviously, Knicks fans listening are like, hey, look what happened since. It's a long season. There's a lot of ebbs and flows. Even though the NBA is not 162 games, it's a long season, and there's ebbs and flows. We all know this, especially when you get to the postseason. As far as a baseball in-season tournament, even Manfred said it's tricky to how it would work. Personally, for me, and he correctly said that records mean a lot, so anytime you change the schedule or play around with it, you're messing with historical records that are the backbone of the sport. Maybe that's something because of steroids, because of commoditization of certain things, whatever it may be, that has to be relooked and maybe not as important. Like pitchers' wins are not as important as they used to be. And you look back at some seasons that as kids we thought, hey, were really great seasons. And you look, well, that was okay. Like I recently looked at Bob Welch's Oakland season in 1990 when he won 27 games, 27-6, and he was okay peripherally. Played for a good team and had some runs scored for him. Not saying he was bad, but he was okay. He wasn't dominant. He wasn't the best pitcher in the sport, even though I think he won a Cy Young Award that year. Now, the other thing that has come up is a free agency deadline because everybody's pissed off about how the offseason is taking too long. And my feeling is these are complicated financial transactions. There's a lot of ebbs and flows to it. These are guys' livelihoods. These are big commitments by teams. And if you rush it or put a clock over their head, mistakes could happen and it could backfire and actually work the opposite. And even Brett Rooker came in and said, look, a deadline in free agency is about as anti-player of a thing that you're ever going to have. He came out on X and said that. Now, Manfred discussed how he put it out there in the last CBA bargaining session. The players don't want it. His feeling is that these are smart people and that if you condense it to 3 weeks, and he's correct in saying 3 weeks in December, when the NBA is still young in the season, the NFL playoffs are not here yet. And let's face it, there's a chunk of the NFL that is playing out the string at that point. There was some awful football at the bottom half of the league. Yeah, I know everybody's into the betting and the fantasy football and everything, but you could potentially, with the way that the hot stove is, really dominate a summer sport during the holidays if you had this flurry of activity, just like for a lot of times the 4th of July weekend has been with the NBA, where, you know, you have all these moves made and you're heading into a holiday weekend and I've personally have been times where during the 4th of July, leading into the 4th of July and after the 4th of July long weekend, you're reading all this NBA content. Now that's changed a little bit with the aprons and stuff like that, but I don't know if it's the Players Association's responsibility to entertain you in the transactions page. I just don't think that that's something that's part of the equation. I think it's a business. Business is not supposed to be entertainment. Does it turn off fans, and would it engage fans more? I think fans are into action. Fans are into and maybe this is me thinking about it the old school way. I think people understanding the beauty of the sport, not the boardroom part of it, is where maybe more focus has to be at. And I still think there's so much forced nature of this. Like, they shove Otani down your throat in a weird way. Nothing is better than growing up and reminiscing about where you were during big moments. I'm sure many of you listening know where you were when Pete Alonso's home run went over the wall. I do. Many of you know where you were and your reaction when Lindor hit the grand slam against the Phillies. I remember where I was watching John Franco strike out Barry Bonds in that postseason spot. I remember being in Citi Field for Benny Agbayani's walk-up home run against the Giants. I remember. And I remember other. I remember where I was and my reaction when Matt Franco got that big hit in the Subway Series against the Yankees in 1999. Baseball is more about those moments and the drama and the buildup and the highs and the lows. And I think that that's something in today's society that's a little bit tougher to keep people's attention span, because back in 1999, I wasn't scrolling the internet to see what people were saying on Twitter, or I didn't have a funny video that I could watch when the game got out of hand, or maybe something to distract me. So maybe I'm wrong, but I think the transaction page or the boardroom or the hot stove, which will keep you engaged, I'm not saying, you know, it's good to drag it out, but I don't know what it really matters. Like, It's like the game itself. When the free agency comes, whether it's all in one spurt or throughout the offseason, you're either going to have drips and drabs and highs and lows where the news flows in the offseason, or you're going to have everything done by Christmas and then it's going to shut down like the NBA. I mean, August nobody talks about the NBA in August unless hardcore NBA fans, unless there's some kind of like gossip about, oh, this one wants out. I mean, after the free agency, it dies off. You got NFL training camps. You got the heart of the baseball season. That's what's going to happen to baseball. You do all the transactions by Christmas. Hey, I'll see you in February. Then you have no baseball talked about, other than maybe the Hall of Fame. Maybe they could market that a little bit better. Does it really accomplish anything different? I don't know. I just think it's an overused thing. I think it's a trinket. I'm not so sure it matters. So that's what I had. Hope you enjoy. So basically, what I'm going to be doing with these mailbags, I'll obviously react to the chat room, to tweets, to directly at me, to emails, you know, whatever. You know, if you want to go through the Talking Mets podcast website, that's okay too, and things like that. But I'm also going to go on and look at interactions we've had throughout a week and maybe illuminate on them during this segment. So I hope that's a good addition to the show. And we'll do them when we can. Maybe sometimes the news makes it where we can't. But if you have a topic that I didn't reach out about, maybe send it to me. Say, hey, Mike, why don't you illuminate on this and that next week? And I'll get to it. What's coming up? So next week we have our Hall of Fame show. And I'm looking forward to that because there's going to be the BBWA announcement. So stay tuned for that. Will we have Mets free agency news? I'm not sure. But at the very least, we'll dive into the Hall of Fame. There'll be talk about Carlos Beltran, of course, who's, I think, likely to get inducted. Maybe we'll dive in if we have time, depending on the news cycle. The Mets had some Hall of Fame announcements for themselves. Maybe I'll dive into those because I nearly haven't talked about it. at the TalkingMetsPodcast.com, Beyond the Mic, the Substack, the premium content. I will write a little bit about maybe some bullpen arms that the Mets are finally going to be able to rely on or potentially take a look at from the farm. I think there's more than you think. I'm sure there'll be more content that we could look at. Maybe look a little bit more at Brett Beatty and where he stands when it comes to the Mets relying on him as a third baseman. Those are some things marinating on my head. I know the feedback I've gotten is that those that want to listen to the audios, because I've been putting out a little bit more audios, can we get a separate podcast for the premium content? I am looking into that. I know it can be done. And I promise you, this is something that I probably won't have till the season starts, because my feeling is during the season, the way that this will work is we'll do the Sunday show, and then throughout the week, not every night, I'm not doing post games, that's not what you need me for. But during the week, when it's pertinent, when there's a reaction that needs to happen, an emotional reaction or a balanced reaction, I'm going to try to come to you with those short little vignettes, so to speak. And if you want to put them into your podcast service, I know it's easier for people than downloading it from the web. So I'm working on that. I'm hoping to have that sooner rather than later. My promise to you is, and I don't want to screw up what the main show is, I got to find a way to kind of demarcate it a little bit, logos and everything. So, you know, that's something just to be on the lookout for. So, all right, want to thank everybody for tuning in to this latest edition of the Talking Mets Podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And you can get me at the new and improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Sign up for premium content. Want to just be a free subscriber? Join us for the chat or get updates about the show. And if you don't like emailing me directly, you could also send me a note through thetalkingmetspodcast.com. And of course, I want to thank the good folks from the Believe Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your week. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.